Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Donald Trump's presidency has frequently engendered the phrase constitutional crisis. Pundits and some politicians have frequently insisted his actions have put us on the verge of one. His undeniably unconventional presidency has been testing the limits of presidential power and raising red flags of concern, but now his administration's refusal to cooperate with congressional investigations has pitted one branch of government against another, the very definition of constitutional crisis. But there are many Americans who don't see that crisis. Could that be because they don't fully understand how our government works? Could it be because these same people who cling to the wisdom of our founding fathers have never read or have forgotten what our key founding document says about how government works? Since we're going to be hearing a lot about executive versus legislative power in the days ahead, and because judicial power may end up intervening in the resulting impasse, perhaps an understanding of the Constitution is more important now than ever before. CBS News legal analyst and professor of law at the University of Baltimore School of Law, Kim Whaley, is here to help. An associate independent counsel in the Whitewater investigation under Special Prosecutor Kenneth Starr and an assistant U.S. attorney in Washington, she has written a book called How to Read the Constitution and Why, and she sheds light on both this hour. Welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thank you.
She joins us from our studios, their studios at NPR in Washington. And if you'd like to join our conversation, you can do it. You can join us via email, charlottetalks@wfae.org, search for WFAE on Facebook, get to us through Twitter @CharlotteTalks. You know, you've been hearing, as we all have, arguments back and forth about the extent of presidential power, about the power of the legislative branch, about oversight duties granted to the legislative branch by the Constitution, and of course, you've heard the phrase constitutional crisis being bandied about. Given what you know about this document, and you know a lot, do you believe that most people understand how our government was designed to work and exactly what the Constitution says about all of this?
I don't think most people understand either of those. A few years ago, the Annenberg Center did a survey and found that I think it was approximately 3,000 respondents. Two-thirds could not name all three branches of government, mm-hmm. and that is the legislative, the executive, and the judicial. If someone were to sit down and read the Constitution, which some people encourage, most people couldn't understand it because it's an old document. It's been massively interpreted over the years by the United States Supreme Court, both progressives and conservatives on that court that add meaning to the Constitution. And thirdly, not many, even learning it in school, it's not taught in a way that explains how it is supposed to function. The book is How to Read the Constitution and Why. The book attempts to teach people how to ride the bike of the Constitution and understand functionally why it's set up the way it is, rather than just rotely understanding or being able to recite what the branches of government each do.
But this document seems to be in our DNA as Americans, and it's kind of shocking when you think people go through a public school or a private school. They go through primary and secondary education. Some of them go to college, and they still don't understand the fundamental document that establishes and runs it all. How can that be?
Well, we hear a lot about constitutional rights. And when I talk about the book, I often ask the audience, what does it mean to have a right? And the answer is, I think correctly in terms of, you know, people's colloquial understanding of the word right, is that it's sort of something that is given to you at birth. But that's not really what a right means under the Constitution. What a right really means is that if government tries to arbitrarily do something to you that's protected under the Constitution, you can go to court and enforce a right. So it really is about a limiting government power, using the court system to basically keep government off your back. The more important really part of the Constitution is the original Constitution. The rights were added later. The Bill of Rights was added later. Mm-hmm. And I say it because the structure is what actually protects us. The fact that the framers took essentially a monarchy, and broke it up into a three-headed monster of government, the executive, the judicial, and the legislative. And the idea is that no branch has all the power. If no branch has all the power, then our individual rights are protected. Each branch gets their papers graded by the other two branches. And that's really the essential concept that is getting lost in this moment in the idea that we're even discussing if there's limits on the executive branch power. The whole point of having a three-part government is so the executive itself as a as an institution, as an office, never gets too powerful. Because when the office becomes too powerful, that power, the framers understood, will be ultimately abused somehow to the disadvantage of regular people.
Do you think that part of the problem is that the president is the only person that everybody in the country gets to vote for? We all have senators, we all have House of Representatives members, but they're all tiny little districts or just two people from a state representing us, whereas the president represents all of us. We all get to vote, even though the popular vote sometimes doesn't determine who the president is, as in the case of Donald Trump. But that's part of the problem, that he or she has become the focal point of all this. And Congress, where a lot of stuff gets hashed out, is a very unpopular organization. It has been for years. Is that part of the problem?
Well, it's very actually nuanced and complicated problem as to why there's so much focus on the presidency and really why there's so much black and white thinking. I do think Congress is misunderstood. I think Congress has abdicated a lot of its authority. Congress is deeply partisan, and it is not functioning in the way it was intended through compromise and committee work and really doing the will of the people. If we think about issues like some kind of measured gun control, like even background checks or immigration reform, the numbers are really high in the 90s. The American populace across the political spectrum wants to see legislation on this stuff. It's not happening. So we have to ask ourselves, is Congress actually working for regular people? You'd say by just that basic fact, probably not, because if they were, we'd see this kind of legislation. And then the question is, then who are they working for? And then at the same time, we have a deeply sort of media frenzied, politicized presidency, office of the presidency, where people feel personally aligned or disaligned with this particular human being. Yeah. And we lose sight again of the office. The office itself has to be held accountable. There has to be, speeding tickets for blowing through speed limits for the presidency. Otherwise, we are going to morph structurally into something that looks like a monarchy and could potentially be a dictatorship. And that's not good for anyone.
Everybody says the founding fathers were geniuses, that they designed this magnificent document that set up this amazing experiment that has worked for over 150 years. But President Obama referred to structural problems in our government that I don't think they have anything to do with the Constitution. We do have structural problems. The primary system, the political parties, the money that has to flow into the system in order for the people to get elected and re-elected seems to be structural problems that divide us down the middle and split us off to the extreme left and the extreme right with nothing in between, and therefore nothing can get done. The Constitution doesn't address any of that.
Well, the Constitution does not create political parties.
Right.
There is no Democrats and Republicans in the Constitution, and that seems to be where people these days feel like their primary allegiance is to their party. And really, the way the framers anticipated this functioning was that the primary allegiance would be to each other. It's we, the people, self-governing. We gift the power of governing us through the Constitution. It's really a contract. It's just a piece of paper to manage politicians' power. But we've gotten into kind of a framework where it's my team versus your team, not each other. And as I say in the book, and I use this metaphor, the Constitution is like a bridge over a river, and we could fight over the blue cops or the red cops directing traffic on the bridge, which cop is the better cop, which cop is crooked, which cop should be in power, etc. Meanwhile, if the bridge itself, the infrastructure of the bridge, is not being tended to, if the grouting is falling apart, if the water is wearing away at the cement, the bridge will fall eventually. And when that happens, everyone goes down. It doesn't matter what your political affiliation is. And that's why we, the people, need to band with each other at the ballot box and take back our government and see each other as really our sort of affiliation, not politicians. Politicians aren't there for us individuals. They're there, you know, understandably, to do good things, some of them, but also to protect their own power in government.
We were talking before the show went on the air that you don't believe that a lot of people fully understand what kind of shaky ground we're on, and how this constitutional document that is the fundamental foundation of everything is kind of built on sand. We have to be very careful. We have to shore it up from time to time. We have to go back to it from time to time and really understand what kind of a precipice we're on. It was written and ratified, I guess, in 1789?
I think it was ratified 1788. Yeah.
So a long, long, long time ago, in a world very different from our own. Today we have Citizens United, which allows big money interests to come in. Today we have very partisan media that puts forth one point of view or the other, and they're at loggerheads. There's no in between. We have these fake presidential debates in which really it's more about the horse race and gotcha moments than it is about policy or about showcasing adult opinions about how we go from point A to point B. How can the Constitution protect us from all of that?
Yeah, you know, you put your finger on a number of problems. So the Constitution is really set up with the idea that people basically, as I indicated, control their own government at the ballot box. But there have been a number of problems. Barack Obama, others might have referred to it, structural problems that aren't in the Constitution itself. I mentioned one, that is this idea of two political parties. The Supreme Court, frankly, has really interfered with the functioning of how the electoral element of our government actually works. You mentioned the case Citizens United. That was a case in which the Supreme Court struck down part of an act of Congress. So when Congress acts, the idea is that's acting through the people. They need to get the votes on behalf of their representatives. The Supreme Court essentially said limits on corporate spending on campaigns are unconstitutional because corporations have First Amendment rights, which we don't need to be a lawyer to understand. I mean, corporations are fictions. They're legal fictions created to protect against tax liability and litigation. Of course, the people within a corporation already have First Amendment rights, but that really blew open a hole in money going into politicians' pockets that don't come from regular voters. We also saw in 2013 a case called Shelby County versus Holder, where the court again basically undermined an act of Congress, declared a part of an act of Congress unconstitutional. That's the Voting Rights Act. And the part of it, and that was also bipartisan, overwhelming numbers, authorized legislation for years that essentially made sure that before certain suspect states could change their rules at the ballot box, could make it kind of harder for people to vote, they had to get that cleared through the federal government so that voting stayed fair and neutral. So that was one aspect of that. And of course, we saw again this year the court closing the doors, the courthouse doors, permanently, essentially, to any claims that political gerrymandering are problematic under the Constitution. Yeah. And for those who don't know what that means, essentially state legislatures decide how stuff works in terms of how to carve up congressional districts. The court said they could do that in a purely political way.
Let me interrupt you because we have to go to a break. Kim Whaley is our guest, How to Read the Constitution and Why, the book. We'll get into the Constitution when we come back. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking this morning with Kim Whaley, who is a professor of law at the University of Baltimore School of Law, a CBS News analyst who also appears frequently on NPR's Morning Edition and on CNN and MSNBC. And she's written this book, How to Read the Constitution and Why, which has been described as urgent, essential reading, particularly in these troubled times in which we live right now. Now, the Constitution is divided up into seven articles, the main Constitution, not the Bill of Rights, the first three of which describe the operations and the duties of the three branches of government. Article 1 focuses on the legislative branch. The founders put that branch first before the executive branch, described in Article 2, and then the judicial branch is described in Article 3. Was that purposeful, that in ordering the Constitution in that manner, were they trying to send a message both to their contemporaries and to future generations about the importance and the function of each branch?
You know, that's a good question. I'm not sure historically how the order of it was lined up, if that was deliberate. Presumably it was, but I think it's important what you put your finger on to keep in mind that the idea really is that the Congress should have a lot of say and how our government functions. The framers were worried about the Congress actually becoming too powerful. So there are ways that the executive branch and the judicial branch limit the power of the Congress. They all sort of check each other. But as we mentioned earlier, one of, I think, the structural problems, why some people say we're at a potential constitutional crisis, is the fact that Congress has given up its power, and we have a presidency now, people in the White House that are trying to basically emasculate Congress even more. And that's problematic because that's the place that people speak on behalf of themselves in terms of how their government should work.
People on the right often criticize Barack Obama's presidency as being a dictatorship. And people on the left today are looking at what the president currently is trying to do and say he's moving us toward an autocracy, a dictatorship. Who's right?
Well, you know, I think the Barack Obama criticism had to do in part with his use of executive orders. And that's been the case since the beginning of time. The time that we've had this particular government in the United States. And executive orders do act like laws. There's a constitutional problem in theory with having presidents make laws. That should be what Congress does. But that's been the case from day one. I do think this particular presidency is more problematic than any we've seen. And as you mentioned, I lived through the Whitewater investigation, was part of the prosecutorial team that was looking into a Democratic president. So I've seen it on both sides. And this particular president is taking the position across the board in the courts that there aren't any limits on the president's power. I don't think we've seen that before. Remember, even Bill Clinton succumbed to, you know, grand jury testimony. He gave DNA blood evidence in connection with the Star Probe. It's inconceivable that President Trump, given his position on basically non-cooperation with Congress, period, would do that kind of thing for the sake of the structure of the Constitution.
Well, given that that set precedent, it seems to me, you have Bill Clinton appearing before a grand jury and testifying. You have him giving the DNA evidence, etc. That sets precedent on the limits of presidential power. Why isn't that being used in this case?
Well, that's a great question. I think one of the issues is we are sort of dealing with a tsunami of information. This investigation, this impeachment process, is one in which Congress has to do the spade work of actually digging up and going through the facts. It's not being handed to Congress, as with Ken Starr, in a big binder of all the facts, or as Mueller produced with respect to the Russian interference in the election. So it's extremely fast-paced. But the other thing that I tell people, and this is one of the structural things about the Constitution people don't understand, that what's in the Constitution is kind of less important than whether it's enforced. So if we have a rule, and I'm a mother, if you have a rule of, you know, your kid can't jump on the couch, but you allow the kid to jump on the couch once in a while, the rule, if it's unenforced, no longer becomes a rule.
Yeah.
Like the Constitution's just a contract. If it's not enforced, then the president can do what he wants. And so precedent, laws, all of that, if there aren't consequence for violating those things, for violating norms, then it becomes okay, regardless of what the text of the Constitution is itself.
And I'm sure this was, I don't recall, but I'm sure this was said at the time of the Bill Clinton impeachment, that there was overstepping of the bounds of congressional power, trying to take a president down. It's certainly being said today about President Trump and the current Congress or the current House of Representatives run by the Democrats. But people have seemed to have forgotten a phrase that sticks in my head from, I guess it was 11th grade political science, and that was checks and balances. That the Congress, each of the three branches of government acts as a check on the other. You say, and it's true, that the Constitution doesn't say anything about separation of powers or checks and balances or even the separation of church and state. There's a lot of squishiness, you say, in the Constitution. Isn't that part of the problem, then? People don't see it, therefore it's not true.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of parts of it that there are a lot of aspects of it that are problematic. But I do think if you look at the memo that was written by Pat Cipollone, the White House counsel, regarding not basically saying we are not going to comply with the congressional impeachment process. In that memo, he essentially says that impeachment itself is unconstitutional. This is not something that's ambiguous in the Constitution. There is an impeachment clause. It is not unconstitutional.
So where do you think that comes from? Where, that assertion that it, to impeach a president is unconstitutional. Where does that originate, that idea?
Well, it's a bit complicated. I think the argument is, listen, impeachment's only constitutional if there's full-blown due process protections in the House of Representatives side
of things.
Not
true, right?
No, I mean, criminal defendants don't get the ability to cross-examine witnesses when the FBI or investigators at the state level are investigating a crime. You don't get due process unless you're indicted. You don't get to sort of probe the inner workings of how a prosecutorial team is building their case. You're on the outside, and it certainly shouldn't be any different for the president when you're really not even talking about going to jail if the Senate convicts. You're basically talking about losing your job, and the rest of us regular people have to worry about losing our job with much less process.
Well, it seems to me that's the other problem with how the Founding Fathers set up impeachment. They made it by virtue of the fact that there is no criminal punishment for criminal activity through the process of impeachment, a trial in the Senate, and conviction. It's only a removal from office and the inability to ever run again. That's the only hammer that they have. So they made it a political process and not a criminal process. Why?
They deliberately made it a political process. But that's not to say that a president cannot be indicted while
right.
in office. That, remember,
that's
an internal policy decision. That's essentially a personnel memo saying, this is what DOJ is telling its prosecutors its priorities are. You know, prosecutors make those kind of determinations all the time. We are going to prosecute these kinds of crimes and prioritize, you know, low-level marijuana possession, for example, or we're not going to prosecute marijuana possession. We're going to go only for the more serious crimes. That's essentially what this non-prosecuting a president memo means. It's not a law, but it's essentially functioned to knock out the judicial branch as a check on potential criminal activity in the White House. Mm. The only check is a political one, either through impeachment or, I think more vitally, frankly, in 2020 November at the ballot box. That election will be a referendum on whether America wants an accountable office of the presidency or whether they're comfortable with unlimited power in the presidency. And to answer your question, I think probably the framers expected the process to work on a bipartisan way, and it's not right now.
Well, they didn't anticipate political parties, so they didn't anticipate bipartisanship, did they? I mean, seriously.
You can historically look back and see a lot of fights politically over the years. But of course, as you mentioned, we have foreign interference in our elections. We have the digital age, which dramatically distorts how this stuff plays out. There are a lot of complicating factors for why the process isn't working. Congress and the Senate level has basically said, we will not, at this moment, exercise our prerogative and obligation to oversee the president. That is a breakdown of the system.
So we have people on one side screaming that this whole thing is unconstitutional. This move to investigate and impeach the president is unconstitutional. You were part of the Whitewater investigation, and I know people on the left were very much opposed to what Kenneth Starr did and how he did it and how far he went. But were they screaming this is unconstitutional?
You know, I was recently on a podcast with my colleague Major Garrett at CBS, and he went back and played a lot of the live, you know, footage, both from the Nixon impeachment process and the Clinton impeachment process. And the point was pretty starkly made through live Clinton clips that, you know, it was a very subdued, respectful process. President Clinton essentially publicly stated he was going to comply and let things, matters unfold. We were not hearing sort of, you know, attacks, personal attacks from the White House against individual prosecutors, against the process. That sort of fever pitch argument against the process itself wasn't playing out publicly. Of course, privately there were serious spats between the White House counsel's office and Ken Starr's office that prosecutors inside that Ken Starr's office were upset about, but it wasn't playing out in the public sector this way. The presidency hummed along in a different way.
But now you have a president who's not afraid of saying things that are beyond the pale and beyond the norms of what presidents have said or done and the language used in the past. And you have a political party that is absolutely in lockstep with the president, with a party over perhaps patriotism, some would allege. But you just said a moment ago that this next, if it doesn't come to impeachment and a trial in the Senate and conviction and removal from office, then the only other option that people have who believe that the president has done wrong is going to be found in the election. And that this election, the framing of this election, is whether we, the people, want unlimited power in the president. What happens if we decide we do?
That we want unlimited power.
Yeah, his reelection would be an indication that that's what they want.
Right, and you know, I'm glad you framed it that way. A recent poll done by Pod Save America sort of asked the question whether you believe the president should be impeached based on XYZ wrongdoing, or whether you believe if the president impeachment is necessary to protect the office of the presidency, something along those lines, you would favor it. Number two polled much higher. People understand when framed that way that it's slightly different than Trump the man. It doesn't really matter what happens to Trump the man. Remember, the revolutionaries fought and died to not have a monarchy. What does a monarchy look like? It means general warrants that historically were in England, where the king could come and rifle through your stuff for no reason. They were just curious about you. What an unaccountable presidency means is arbitrary power, is that you could be basically renditioned from the street for no reason. Your family doesn't see you again because of your political views. And if people think that's hyperbole and extreme, I turn back to sort of basic psychology. The framers understood unlimited power will be abused. It's human nature to amass, entrench, and abuse power. That is why they set up essentially a job description with consequences for violating or abusing the power of office. And as I tell people, when the stormtroopers are at your back door because your political views don't align with whoever happens to be in that unlimited office of the presidency, it is too late. It's too late at that moment. Now is the time to exercise the prerogative of we the people to be the boss of our own government. Now is the moment for, and we need to do it not just for ourselves, but for our children and our grandchildren who don't have the ability to go to the ballot box in November.
But if Donald Trump supporters hear you talking, they may think that you are a partisan and that you are against Donald Trump, when in fact what you're saying is, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, that we need to protect the Constitution and that the man in charge at the moment, the man in the Oval Office at the moment, is pushing the boundaries. He is changing the norms that have supported our system of government and our system of our democratic system, period, to the point where it could all dissolve. And then where are we? That's what you're saying.
Absolutely.
Why don't they see that? Mm-hmm. Why don't they see that? And what do you tell them to make them understand what your point of view is?
Yeah, I think because we are, again, in this politicized environment where people are aligning with the team. Team Trump. The idea is I'm emotionally associated with that man, and it's hard to see, to step back and see structurally what's really at stake. I mean, everyone who's listening probably has had a job or knows someone who's had a job. And, you know, I use the example in the book of, you know, a restaurant. If you're a mom and pop restaurant owner, you might try to hire the best possible people to run your restaurant. But if there aren't consequences for stealing from the cash register, if there maybe isn't a video camera here and there to make sure that, you know, liquor's not going out from behind the bar, if there aren't requirements that people show up in the job, and if they don't actually show up for service so customers don't get their food, they get fired. If there aren't consequences, the restaurant will go under. I mean, that's just the way it is. So I think if people think about it in terms of their common sense, people are smart. I personally am much less invested in what happens to this man because no one lives forever. But I do care about the preserving the privilege of having an accountable government.
Donald Trump is part of a progression that has been going on for a very long time. And also just the idea that the presidency has become so powerful and such a focal point in our government seems to be something that happened really with the dawn of the mid-20th century, when television came into being and the president could speak directly to people. You never heard Calvin Coolidge talk to people. You never heard Warren G. Harding talk to people, maybe once or twice. But now it's every single day, every hour of every single day, in fact. And over time, the presidency has taken on powers that really belong to the Congress, and the Congress hasn't pushed back, like the power to declare war. We haven't declared war since World War II, but we've been in a constant state of war, except for a couple of years, from Harry Truman on. So is Congress to blame for some of this? They just said, well, you take it. We don't want to deal with this.
Absolutely. Congress is very much to blame. And there are a lot of reasons. We talked about some of it, gerrymandering, money and politics. Essentially a decision, I think, in the early 90s by the Republicans under Newt Gingrich that fighting the other side is going to enhance their relative political power. This is why we saw government shutdowns, things like that, sort of scorched earth, brass knuckle tactics. But the other piece is, and you mentioned television, I mean, of course, historically, George Washington was uncomfortable speaking in public. I mean, you have to have candidates that know how to sort of be public figures in a way that the media likes.
Yeah.
But the internet and technology in the last 20, 30 years have dramatically shifted so many aspects of our government that Congress is worried about basically being kicked out of office through a tweet. That really does affect how they act in the chamber.
Kim Whaley's book is called How to Read the Constitution and Why. We'll get back to our conversation in just a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Kim Whaley is our guest. That's WEHLE, if you're looking for her book, How to Read the Constitution and Why. She's a professor of law at the University of Baltimore School of Law and a frequent contributor to Morning Edition and to CBS News as a legal analyst. You say that today a lot of questions that are being posed by this administration and the current Congress are not answered anywhere in law. The Supreme Court has not addressed these at all, and so we can hypothesize as to what the proper answers to the questions are. We can have debates about them, but there is really no thumbs up or thumbs down on a lot of this stuff. Wow. So what good is the Constitution in this case?
Yeah, that gives people, I think, some pause. But it also, you know, if we were to amend the Constitution every time we needed some clarification, it would go on for volumes and volumes and volumes. I mean, the Constitution is hard to amend by we the people on purpose because the framers, I think, wanted some stability and wanted some consistency. But the problem is, because it's so ambiguous, when constitutional issues go to the United States Supreme Court and the court in a 5-4 decision decide something under the Constitution, and now we've got a, you know, conservative majority, they will decide cases under the Constitution. We have some big ones coming up this term.
Mm-hmm.
That is essentially like amending the Constitution. That's five unelected people who are there for life making substantive footnotes to the Constitution, when if we the people were to do it, it would be close to impossible. You need two-thirds of both houses of Congress and then three-quarters of the states to ratify a change. So back to your earlier point, that might be a structural problem in the Constitution in an environment where political compromise is considered kryptonite.
Yeah, and right now we've gotten to this point where one party is strictly behind the president, who's been accused by the other party of doing things that border on criminality and certainly weaken the institutions of government and our relationships with allies, etc. Right now, Democrats see what Trump is doing and they want to rein him in. Shouldn't Republicans want to rein him in? Given that someday, unless this thing all collapses at the end of the next 2 years, that there will be a Democrat in the White House who may want to take things further than even Donald Trump. Shouldn't the Republicans want to get control over this?
Sure. I mean, the Republicans should want to protect the prerogative of the United States Congress. What I tell people, you mentioned Trump supporters, you know, if you really support this president, you know, that's fine. Then you have to ask yourself, if you give the office unlimited power, who's your worst case scenario person to have that power? If you're comfortable with that person, that politician who maybe you don't like, walking into an office and being able to basically exercise unlimited power with Congress unable to do anything and the courts unable to do anything, if you're okay with that, then don't pay attention to the Constitution. But I think most people are not okay with that. But as I said earlier, I do think that, you know, technology and the way this particular president is willing to take the gloves off and, you know, do personal attacks on political opponents, that is essentially hamstringing Senate Republicans from exercising or feeling free to exercise the prerogative. There's a deep lack of courage because they're afraid if they come out against the president, or at least reportedly, if they come out against the president, there'll be a tweet and they'll lose their seat, and that'll be that. So
Isn't that worth it? I mean, if you really care about the Constitution, isn't that worth it? What is wrong with people? Have we lost our sense of right and wrong in this country?
What I don't understand is why they can't get in a room and see this for what it is and stand together on behalf of the American people. I think there's safety in numbers, right? We know this is why unions sprung up on the 20th century. The idea, if you speak with a unified voice, I also think prior presidents could, from both sides of the aisle, get together and inform the American public why this matters so much in this moment. And even if, you know, again, even if you like this particular president, the drama and the strain and the chaos and the trauma day by day with body blow after body blow is not good for the regular functioning of government. I mean, it's just time to kind of calm things down. We need control alt delete and just, you know, go back to some measure of business as usual, if that's even possible in this moment.
As you said at the very beginning of our conversation, a lot of people have not read the Constitution. And when they do, they find it difficult to read because it is old. It's written in an arcane kind of language in some ways. It is difficult to understand. It's vague in some places. You have to have some understanding of how the Constitution has been interpreted over time to understand how to read the document. But you've laid it out in your book in fairly contemporary, easy to understand English. But let's talk about some basic questions that speak only to what's happening right now. Mm-hmm. Does the Trump administration have the legal right to refuse to comply with congressional subpoenas or to refuse to allow personnel to testify?
Generally, the answer is no. Congress has, pursuant to the speech and debate clause, the power to gather facts, and certainly pursuant to the impeachment clause, the power to gather facts. Congress can't do its job based on abstract notions. They need to have information in front of them to decide whether to take action. That is implied, again, in the Constitution. The White House can send a lawyer in certain circumstances to preserve privileges, to say, listen, that particular question is asking for something that falls within executive privilege. I direct the witness not to answer. But this notion that blanket refusal to comply, no. But as I said earlier, if there's no enforcement of a subpoena,
right,
then the office gets that power.
Well, I want to pursue that in a second, but Barry emails a question about executive privilege and how it fits into the Constitution, because it's not in the Constitution, but it seems to be the tool that presidents, not just this one, but presidents use to push back against congressional oversight. So what about the concept of executive privilege?
Okay, so privilege is something that we as a sort of as a policy matter, we think we should keep from public view. We've heard about the attorney-client privilege, the idea if you get information about a legal right from a lawyer, we don't want that made public because then people won't go to lawyers. The idea behind executive privilege is there's some conversations that presidents need to have with their top closest advisors that have to be protected. Otherwise, the president can't do his or her job in the moment. But it's not some blanket protection of immunity from any information out of the White House. It's essentially a question-by-question block on certain information. And generally, privileged material, if there's a question as to whether it's actually privileged, that would go to the courts.
Well, what about those phone calls that they have moved to a special server because, I guess, because they were, well, one presumes because they were concerned about the content of the calls. Does that fall under executive privilege? Here's a guy trying to have a conversation with another foreign leader that really, by all standards, shouldn't necessarily be public.
Yeah, so, you know, executive privilege is, again, designed to protect a certain series of policy objectives, including, for example, national security. That telephone call, given that, based on the summary of the transcript, was about asking a foreign leader to start an investigation or continue investigation into a political opponent, that it's hard to see where that would fall within executive privilege. And for lots of privileges, including attorney-client, if there are other people on the call, that waives the privilege. That is, okay. You can't kind of put the genie back in the bottle. So there's some potential problems.
Even if they're members of the executive branch, I mean, the attorney general was alleged to be on the call. He is a lawyer. He's not the president's lawyer, but he is a member of the executive branch. Wouldn't that fall under privilege?
So an important thing to keep in mind with that particular transcript is that the White House volunteered and unilaterally made that public. That wasn't asked for by the Congress. And so I know what we're hearing, the argument that somehow that is problematic in terms of protecting the president's prerogative. But that was President Trump's decision to put the president's prerogative at risk. It was a decision politically to get out in front of the story. But that wasn't ordered by a court. That wasn't even asked for by Congress. That was this president's decision to make that summary of the transcript public. So he, in that moment, waived any privilege with respect to that call.
So the Congress puts out subpoenas, asks witnesses to come and testify. The administration says, no, we're going to ignore your subpoenas. We're going to tell people they can't testify. What's the legal recourse that Congress has constitutionally?
Well, there is an inherent power for Congress to protect, I mean, courts have recognized, to protect its own subpoena power. So Congress could, in theory, call the sergeant of arms to arrest a noncompliant witness.
But the sergeant of arms is usually this old guy who announces the president at the State of the Union address. He's going to go out and arrest somebody?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, some people on, you know, one end of the political spectrum have been quite critical of the notion that that shouldn't be pulled. I've said it publicly. I think that's not realistic. I think that would be divisive and really problematic. I don't even know how that would function. So I think that's out for a lot of reasons. Number two, the Congress could go to the Justice Department and say, Attorney General Barr, please, you know, take up a criminal action to enforce our contempt citation and with respect to refusal to comply with the subpoena. Of course, Bill Barr's not going to do that because he's in line with the president. Number three would be to file a separate lawsuit with the United States Supreme Court, federal courts, and ask for a judge to order compliance with the subpoena. Then the question becomes, will the president comply with that branch of government? Even if there is an order, will the president comply? If, you know, some people, there's a slippery slope of constitutional crises. If the presidency says, you know, not only are we not complying with Congress, we're not complying with the federal courts, then we have a one branch system of governments. Then we're in real trouble. I think we are legitimately within a constitutional crisis.
So we're not there yet, but we could be. Is that what you're saying?
You know, it depends on who you talk to. I think that would be, I don't think that's beyond the pale for this president.
Right.
There was a question with respect to the adding the citizenship question on the census, whether when the Supreme Court said that couldn't be added, there was floating in the media that the White House was considering not adhering to the Supreme Court's decision. You know, I think this president is willing to cross boundaries not enforced.
Well, there are those who believe he won't leave. If he loses the election or at the end of his second term, if he wins, that he won't leave.
Well,
what then?
Nancy Pelosi has said, and I know she's a controversial figure to some people, but she has said, you know, from the Democratic side of view, the 2020 November election, it has to be a win by substantial margins. That might be one reason, so that there's a very clear mandate for him to leave. Secondly, the Electoral College tends to swing against the popular vote in a close election. And I don't think the country can sustain another sort of mixed election in that way. People feel very wronged by how this president came into office, which could also be why we're so politicized in this moment.
Yeah. But suppose you have a moment in time where the president, not just this one, any president, says, I'm not leaving. I'm doing what I want to do. I'm the president. I'm the king. I'm the one that knows everything, and I'm going to do what I want to do. Make me stop. He has the military. He has the Justice Department. He has the FBI. He has the CIA. He has everything.
Yeah. So when this president attacks the executive branch and talks about deep state conspiracies, he's in charge of everybody. He's the boss of them all. And so if he refused to leave, then the question would be who's going to force him, and all the government employees who would be responsible for sort of enforcing the law answer to him. So then the question would become, would the U.S. Marshals Service, would the FBI, who would they answer to? Would they answer to this president? Would they answer to a president-elect? I don't know. That would be full chaos.
I mean, is this a design flaw in the Constitution?
Well, you know, the framers didn't expect it to last more than a couple decades. They might be astonished that we're here. And I know a lot of people think the Constitution should be amended. My argument is it's doing pretty well if it's enforced. Yeah. Let's start enforcing it.
So if the House proceeds down the road to impeachment and they, in fact, impeach the president, that just simply means they think he's guilty of something, and therefore we're going to send it to the Senate, and the Senate will have this trial presided over by the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court.
Correct. It's like an indictment. It's like a grand jury.
Right.
The House acts like a grand jury and gives a list of potential wrongdoing. They don't have to be crimes for purposes of impeachment. Lying to the public, perjuring yourself or lying from the bully pulpit itself could be grounds for impeachment historically.
The Constitution says very little about impeachment, just what it consists of: treason, bribery, high crimes and misdemeanors, and that the House shall draw up articles of impeachment, and then the trial will take place in the Senate. Does the Senate have to have a trial? Can Mitch McConnell say, nope, don't think so? Or can he short-circuit the trial in some way? Yep, we've got to have a trial. So we'll have the trial, but we'll last 3 hours on a Tuesday, and then it'll be done.
Sure, he could absolutely do that. The Senate will set its own internal rules. There could be a motion by the majority party to dismiss the articles of impeachment, just like a defendant in a criminal trial could move to dismiss an indictment and a judge could grant it. In this instance, the majority could decide whatever the House did doesn't go any further. All of these are political judgments. There has to be pushback by the public for the elected representatives to see the process through to the end in a fair way.
Wow. Do you think that it could come to that the Senate would simply ignore the articles of impeachment or short circuit them in some way or just give them short shrift? Would the Supreme Court Chief Justice have something to say about that?
Yeah, all of this is there are open questions. But remember, the Article 2 of the Constitution gives the president the power to appoint Supreme Court justices. And Mitch McConnell, Senate Majority Leader, refused to even bring that to Merrick Garland's nomination to the floor. That's not his power under the Constitution. He flexed that muscle, and Barack Obama, frankly, didn't stand up for the Constitution in that moment. So we'll have to see how this plays out. I do think there's so much fact gathering that has to happen. Really in the House, much more than with Nixon when there was a special prosecutor, Jaworski, with Whitewater when there was Ken Starr. I'm not so sure all of this will wrap up before the November 2020 election. A lot of it just might be fodder for voters, and I think people should pay careful attention to the primary facts, look to the extent to which you can hear from the witnesses, you can read source documents for yourself, do it, educate yourself, and the book itself also breaks down the Constitution so you can draw your own conclusions. Don't take my word for it. Do it yourself.
And that's what the book is about.
Correct.
Our guest today, Kim Whaley, professor of law, University of Baltimore School of Law. And her book is called How to Read the Constitution and Why. I have about 1,000 more questions and no more time.
I'll have to come back, Ben.
Yes, you
my
will.
Next book on voting next summer. Maybe
all right.
We'll talk about that.
Thank you for the hour. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Mike.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.